tonight on Arena. Live music from Oliver Cole and at the Dublin Theatre Festival, Deaf Republic and Beckett, Sa Craig, Gochnamon. If you'd like to text us tonight, you can, 51551. Email is arena@rte.ie. We are on Instagram these days as well, @RTE_arena. Kells musician Oliver Cole, formerly the frontman of the rock band Turn, releases his fourth solo album, Wingspan, this Friday. Turn were one of Ireland's most successful alternative bands of the early 00s. They released 3 top 10 albums and earned a Choice Music Prize nomination. Recorded at his home studio, The Coal Shed, I like it. Wingspan is his first new album in 5 years. And I'm delighted to be joined by Oliver Cole now. Welcome to Arena.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Congratulations on Wingspan. It's the fourth album at this stage. How does it feel? Does it feel in any way different releasing this one compared to Father, Brother, Son, the last one, which is about 4 or 5 years ago now?
Interestingly, all of my solo albums have been 5 years apart.
Okay. Through design or?
They're written and recorded quite quick, and then there's it's the back end I tend to be very slow at, the getting it actually out. All of the making sure it's in the shops and making sure all that side of stuff. Like most creative people, I think I'm naturally bad at that sort of stuff.
So it's not just an obsession with production values?
Let me rephrase. Yes, it is. No, I am quite finicky with stuff like that as well. And this album being an album I recorded myself, I've always kind of dabbled in recording. I like recording. I like microphones and gear and stuff like that. But I built the Coal Shed, which is the studio at the end of the garden. And I was determined to record this album there. So good and bad things about recording your own album. It's you get to spend as long as you want making things perfect, and you get to spend time with it and stuff. But I wouldn't do it again. It's good to have someone to bounce off. You're kind of shouting at the wall a lot. You kind of need another person to be involved, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, just somebody to reassure you that it's good.
So explain to me then the difference maybe between the last album and this one. What's the change been?
Musically, do you mean?
Yeah.
I think the last album had such a strong theme running through it because I had a bunch of major life events. My son was born, my brother died and my mother died. There was a lot of death and birth and kind of growing up thinking a lot about life. It's a quite a grateful record, even though it deals with a lot of serious things. It's quite a positive record, but every single song is linked to that overall theme. And this one, actually, if I'm being honest, I struggled a little bit with this one because I didn't have that. I like to think of albums like, you know, if you, Rick, had an art exhibition and I walked in and all your paintings, you had all 12 paintings up on the white walls. I like to think that I would walk in and I would see that all of these paintings belong together as part of this thing. And I think albums like that, I think that all of these songs should be related to each other. And I struggled with this one because I didn't have that theme. I just was like, I don't know what these songs are about, until eventually I gave in to the fact that I just realised, okay, well, let them be what they are. This album, I would describe it as more of a stream of consciousness, lyrically more of a stream of consciousness thing. Like when I first started writing the song, the initial lyric that came, I didn't mess with it too much. In the past, I would have used that lyric to write the melody and then developed the lyric later on into what I wanted it to be. But this time I was like, I'm just going to leave it.
Yeah,
what it is.
And I kind of wanted to ask you about that because I'm somebody who's been listening to your music since the beginning, which we're talking about almost 25 years now at this stage. How has that changed for you? Are you that sort of person now as a writer? Is that something that comes with, and I don't like to use the word, but here we are, getting slightly older?
I think getting slightly older, I'm more of a perfectionist now than I was, and to my detriment sometimes a little bit. I think when you're younger and you're in a band like Turn, there was 3 of us and we were all really good mates, and we thought we were brilliant. And that's a great that's a great way to get stuff done. Now, looking back, there's definitely stuff, third stuff I look at and go, I should have spent a bit more time on that. I should have spent a bit more time, whatever. But that fellowship you have with a band is a great, because you're allowed to have your down moments or even your bad gig, and someone beside you just goes, shut up, what are you talking about? It was brilliant. And then after a while, you're like, oh, maybe it was. So I think, the songwriting, I'm probably as prolific as I always was. I'm fairly prolific. I'm always writing. I play music every day and I write every day. I try. But I'm a bit discerning, more discerning now. That slows me down, the not having Gavin Fox beside me going, that's the best song you ever wrote. It's like, you need that, I think, sometimes.
So who do you bounce those songs off, if anybody?
I think my wife, she glazes over when I ask her, which do you think is a better chorus? I see her patiently look at me and give me the time to play our both choruses, which probably sound almost identical. And then she'll go, this is the second one, maybe the first one. But I do have, in the end, there's a few good musician friends. Joe Wall from The Stunning is a very good very good feedbacker. You can send Joe stuff and he'll give you like a few pages of an email where he'll tell you exactly what he thinks. People like that are great to have. And then ultimately, I think it was David Bowie that said, records aren't finished, they're abandoned. And I've learned that this is true. At some point you just go, that's it, it's done.
I think that's true of most creative works. Yeah. I want to go back to the recording again, just briefly, because this is the first time that you've recorded yourself in your own studio down the bottom of the garden. And that's obviously a different experience than it would have been previously, where you would have had limited amount of time. You would have gone into a studio every time you went. That costs some form of money, or you need it. But you have the ability to do anything you want. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Bit of both. Same thing. Good in the fact that you can, I tend to work, like probably most people, I suppose, who are songwriters are, it would be nice to be disciplined and say, I'm going to do this every day. But you tend to work in bursts of energy where you're like obsessed with it. Excuse me. For maybe 3 or 4 weeks, and you're just in there all the time. And then there could be a month or two of kind of moments of doubt or whatever it is, where you're just not going in there at all. But I think ultimately for me, I like that when I have that sort of creative firing on all engines thing, I'll just spend all my time there for weeks and then done again.
Okay, you're going to play something for us now from the album. What is it? Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this song's called High and Low. And I heard a musicologist talking once about how there are only three types of songs in the world. There's the one is, I really want to be with that person. Two is, I'm with that person and everything is fantastic. And three is, I'm devastated because I'm not with that person anymore. And I would argue that this might be a fourth type. This is almost like what could I call it? I was nearly going to call it a spite song. It kind of is a spite song. It's like that moment where when the relationship first ends and you think everything is your fault and you just go through it all in your mind. You're like, oh my God, you're reliving things. You're going, it's definitely my fault. And after going through everything in your mind enough, thinking it's your fault, you eventually arrive at the point where it's actually your parents' fault. So you can blame them for a while too. But then you arrive at this point where it's a moment of realizing where you think it wasn't actually all my fault. Actually, that person was a little bit annoying too, perhaps. Okay. So that's what it is. High and low. Called you up that morning to apologize, see if you were all right. I was with the dawn again, distracting myself in the way that I know best. And I was high, I was high and you were low. I was high and
both got married to start again. Did you learn anything? Or are you still that same mess you were back then? Well, I guess it's not my problem now. I was high, I was high and you were low. I was high and you were low. I heard that you were living on the outskirts of town, in his mother's garden house. Well, all of you could see me. Oh, you'd laugh out loud. I'm so responsible now. I was high, I was high and you were low. I was high and you were low. And I only said sorry to make you feel better. And I make you feel better.
And you're listening to Monday Night's Arena. That's Oliver Cole. I'm conscious that we've made it this far into the conversation without mentioning that Leila Keeney is sitting next to you. Leila, you're going to sing on the second song first, but you met Oliver through his work at BIM when he was lecturing there.
Yes, I met Ollie Cole at BIM. I graduated in 2019 and he was my teacher in first year and maybe some second year as well. And Ollie kind of like, you know, if he likes a singer, he's just so excited and he wants to collab. So I've done a few bits with Ollie now and sang on his last album a little bit. But this particular song on this album, I feel like it's more of a duet rather than just backing vocals. So yeah. It's nice.
And tell me about your own music as well.
Yeah, so being at BIM really helped me develop my style, and I released my album Untangled last November, and that, I know Ollie was talking about how, you know, he found his latest album was more of a stream of consciousness and it didn't have to fit into a specific theme. I think my album does have a theme, but style-wise, I have a lot of love for raw American roots. So there's some kind of live band sounds within it. But then I got really into electronic sounds and drum and bass because I was working with an electronic producer. So I think there's a sort of thematic thread, but there are there's a bit of movement genre-wise within it, which I found great. I think it's good to follow your instincts rather than, oh, it has to be a certain way.
And the album's called Untangled.
It is, yes. Okay.
You've spoken before about having crises of confidence during this album.
Every album takes 5 years. If I didn't have the crisis of confidence, I'd have an album every year.
What gets you through that? Because I've also seen you talk about the musicians that you've worked with. So Leila and Gav Fox and Jason Oglesby and the great Graham Hopkins. Like, what do they all bring to your music?
Everybody brings, Graham is an unbelievable beacon of positivity. and actually a incredible musician. Him, there's a bass player called Robbie Malone I play with as well sometimes. They just have this unbelievable sort of enthusiasm for music, and also like no filter with telling you something's terrible as well. But it's actually, they're just like, ah, Jesus, that's so boring. Would you not, like, come here, give me that. You know, they just get stuck in. And
for people who don't know, we should probably fill in that Graham Hopkins is the drummer with Therapy and the drummer with a whole bunch of other bands.
Played with the Cranberries, played with everybody. Yeah. And then Robbie Malone, who I just dropped there as well, is David Gray's full-time bass player. But a great sort of positive thing. Gavin, it is important to have all of those people. They all bring something different, actually.
What drives you to keep making music at this stage? You've been doing it for, you know, it'll be 3 decades in a little while. Yeah. Tell me about that.
I just love it. Like, I love songwriting. I love the fact that you can sit down and start to play the piano. I play a lot of piano these days, and it's like you can find a little thread and you don't really know where it's going, but you're just kind of tipping away at it and you're following it. And like, if you're lucky and things just go your way, you have something within an hour or two that just did not exist in the world before then. And sometimes it's the truest expression of yourself, or the truest expression of like anybody almost. Like, music has a way of, because when you're trying to find the melody, you're playing the chords and you're singing, but you're not really paying attention to what's coming out of your mouth, but stuff is coming out of your mouth. And I tend to just leave the voice memo running. So, and then I'll often think after spending a long time recording something, I'll think, oh, I have to write the lyric for that. But then when I listen back to the recording, the lyric's already there. And usually it's telling me something that I've been kind of, it's got this prophetic thing. Like, it's telling you something that you probably know, but you haven't been dealing with. It sort of has a way of bubbling up through the music.
Like a form of therapy.
Like a form. But when you do it and you do it right, it's not a selfish or personal thing. The things that come out echo with everyone. You know, they just, that combination of that word with that particular chord at that time hits everyone, and they just go, oh, I get it.
Okay, you're going to play something else for, what is it?
This is called, what's this one called? Please Let It Go.
Let It Go, yeah.
And this has Layla. You never asked me anything. You just knew.
The line between us fell, and I tried, but I can't make no sense of it, baby, this time.
Is there nothing I can do to make this all right? Secrets from you.
I know,
but I felt so alone, and I should have, oh, said it, oh, said it at the time. I know, and now it's too late. Oh, baby,
will this time
That's fantastic. Thanks a billion. My thanks to Ollie Cole and to Leila Keeney there as well. The album Wingspan is out this Friday. You can see him live on the 18th of October at the Shantee in Kilkenny, with Mundy on the 25th of October for the album launch, which is going to be in the Book Market in Kells, 15th of November in Smock Alley in Dublin, and on the 28th of November at the United Arts Club in Dublin, hosted by Max Greenwood. Now, Deaf Republic is a new stage adaptation of an award-winning book, a narrative poem by Ukrainian-American poet Ilya Kaminsky. It comes to the Samuel Beckett Theatre this week as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. A young deaf boy is shot dead at a puppet show because he cannot hear a soldier's orders. The town goes deaf overnight. What unfolds is the story of a town's solidarity and resistance to occupying forces. Deaf Republic is told through a mix of spoken English, Irish Sign Language, witty surtitles and silence by an ensemble of deaf and hearing actors, aerial performers, puppetry and live cinema. It is a co-production by Dublin theatre company Dead Centre and London's Royal Court. Fresh from their London premiere, I am pleased to be joined in studio by two of the cast, Lisa Kelly and Caoimhe Coburn-Gray. And you may hear some short pauses because we're also being joined by Irish Sign Language interpreter Aoife Harrington, who will be signing my questions for Lisa, who is deaf. If you would like to watch, you can. Find our live stream at rte.ie/arena and you'll be able to see all of us on screen. Caoimhe, I'm going to start with you. Deaf Republic is set in a fictional place called Vysenka. It tells a story which has its origin in Ilya Kaminsky's own story. So how does his own life influence his work?
Yeah, I think there's a number of elements of the story of Deaf Republic that I think directly touch on Ukrainian cultural references, like the tradition of puppeteering and puppet theatres. And I know that the inspiration for the poetry collection came from Kaminsky's own experience of his family being displaced and fleeing Ukraine and moving to the States when he was a child. So there is that. And then obviously the name of the town, the names of its characters are all somewhat Eastern European and Ukrainian. But at the same time, I think that there's a beautiful thing that Ilya Kaminsky has done in keeping Vysenka as a fictional place. I think there's a universality that's allowed for in it being nowhere. And then at the same time, unfortunately, it gets to be everywhere in terms of the events that take place. So I do think that was a decision to keep it universal, because it means that Vysenka can be Ukraine, it can be Gaza, it can be the West Bank, it can be the Troubles, it can be any number of historical contexts and current events. And I think that there's something really powerful in that.
Lisa, you're an actor who happens to be deaf. Ilya Kaminsky is hard of hearing himself. This play gives centre stage to the world as experienced by people with partial hearing or with no hearing at all. So tell us about the wonderful, and it is wonderful, opening speech made in sign language by Romel Belcher, who's the actor playing Alfonso in the play.
Yes, so Alfonso at the start of the show really takes centre stage with Caoimhe, who's playing Sonia, and she's at the side of the stage interpreting, and Romel Alfonso is at the start saying about the accessibility of the show, and he's saying sorry to the deaf audience that the interpreter is becoming a distraction, and hopes it isn't too much of a distraction to her speaking what he's saying in the corner. And this gives a comedic view to the deaf audience, because that's often how they experience, like hearing people, for example, would often look at the interpreter and feel like it's in the way, it's an annoyance. So it gives that comedic, subverted experience. And the roles really are reversed for the hearing audience, because they depend on sound, whereas deaf people are more visual. We're a visual world. So that changes the perspective and changes the experience of what mainstream theatre normally is. So when people are voicing over, for me, hearing people will often look at the interpreter, because that's the sound, that's where the sound is coming from. But I'm the one who's talking, not the interpreter. So I have to remind people to please look at me when I'm signing. And then it's that reminder that happens. So when people are watching the theatre, it's this change, it's the upended privilege that they have from mainstream theatre. So then they feel like the odd one out because they can sign. And Alfonso at the start does say, really, the only people who are going to fully understand this are the deaf audience. And that's true, because parts of the sign have no captioning, no voiceover. It's fully signs. And that silence is that change of experience. It really upends that normal mainstream theatre production.
It does. Lisa, you grew up in Belfast with deaf parents. They would have had rather more benign dealings with soldiers during the Troubles than is the fate of the little boy, Petia, in the play?
Yes. So my parents were on and off again for a while. My mum was a Protestant from Northern Ireland and my dad was a Catholic from Galway. So really the difference in religion made them be on and off, but then they got married and they got married in a Protestant church, but they had to raise us four girls as Catholics. So that was the agreement when they were married. And my dad used to drive up to Northern Ireland to visit my mum. And at checkpoints, he was stopped and asked for ID. And my dad would show them their ID and they tried to ask more questions. But really, my dad was like, I'm deaf. And they let him on through because they couldn't communicate with him. And this was very lucky because they couldn't ask those serious questions. I know other men who the soldier shot and held a gunpoint, and he was panicking. He was like, I'm deaf. And then they eventually let him on through. And it was lucky because Petya did die in the play because he couldn't hear the soldier's orders. He couldn't hear him because he was deaf. And even in Tyrone, there was a man waving at the soldiers to say, I'm deaf. And they thought he was waving, holding a gun, and they shot him dead. And only in 2021 did they recognise that it happened and that he didn't have a gun. So it can happen in real life too, what's happened in the play.
Kiva, you play Sonia, one half of the couple who put on the puppet show in the first place. Tell us about Sonia and Alfonso and the boy Petia and the town that they're living in.
Yeah, so Sonia and Alfonso are a married couple who run a puppet theatre in Vesenca. And Sonia is Petia, the young deaf child who's shot, she's his cousin. So I think through having that direct family connection in the immediate aftermath of his death, she's maybe the most impacted. And then as we see the resistance grow and the town become deaf, she becomes an organiser and a teacher and begins to teach sign to the townspeople with Alfonso. But I think as well within the piece, Sonia and Alfonso are sort of a representation of the humanity that continues even in times of war, and the very mundane but beautiful everydayness of their love, I think, offers somewhat of a reprieve from the grimness of the state of Vesenca once the occupation takes hold. So they are simultaneously activists and part of the resistance, and then also actually just their love and them continuing to live what they can of a normal life is also another form of resistance that's represented in the show.
Deaf Republic brings together your signing skills and your life as an actor as well. Given that your mother, Veronica Coburn, is a writer, an actor, a director, and your sibling, Caris, is a playwright with a new show, Bond, about to open at the Peacock, was working in theatre for you something that was more likely to happen than not?
I think definitely more likely, yeah. Obviously, I had a reference point for a life in the arts growing up, which I think just inherently makes it easier to picture yourself doing it. And then I was a member of Dublin Youth Theatre, DYT, and always loved drama and performing. And then when I started my studies in Trinity, in Deaf Studies, in the Centre for Deaf Studies, I also joined DU Players, which is the Drama Society in Trinity. And so I guess already those two worlds were kind of coexisting throughout my studies, where I was either in the CDS, the Centre for Deaf Studies, or in Players, meeting people who I still make work with and make theatre with today. And so then when I graduated, I think I already had a little bit of a precedent for keeping both going and feeling very passionately about both. So then it kind of, yeah, it properly clarified things once I was graduated. I was like, okay, I will. I'll give it a go. I'll try and make both happen.
Lisa, at the start of the play, Sonia is using puppets to entertain people, and she and Alfonso appear at times as puppets themselves. But later on, the idea of puppets and of who is controlling who turns much darker.
Yes, at the start of the show, we can see Alfonso and Sonia using the puppets to allow people and children to watch and enjoy them as like a form of light entertainment during war times. And then later on in the play, this does change. The puppets become what's going on in the show. But at the same time, the humans then also become puppets. And it leads to a more darker, eerier sense of what's happening.
Caoimhe, Dead Centre and London's Royal Court, they're the two companies behind Deaf Republic. Anybody who's seen a Dead Centre show in Ireland at any stage over the last number of years will know to expect the unexpected is probably fair. What do you think, or what do you hope that audiences will take away from the play?
I would think that audiences will come away having had a sensory treat of a theatre experience, whether they are hearing or deaf. I think it's a really exciting piece of theatre, both in form and in the language and the text. And I would hope that audiences also leave feeling challenged, both in, I think, the comfort and complacency that we all feel in the face of war and conflict that is happening outside the bounds of our own everyday lives, but also that audiences might feel challenged in how they think about accessibility and the idea that accessibility can be creative. It doesn't have to come in this one familiar form that we associate it with. And it is something that can be played with as long as you play with it in the right way and with the right people in the room. Challenged.
Well, Lisa Kelly, Caoimhe Coburn-Gray, who are two of the actors, and our ISL interpreter tonight, Aoife Harrington, thank you all three of you for joining me tonight. Deaf Republic previews at the Samuel Beckett Theatre on the 2nd of October and then runs there from the 3rd to the 5th as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. More details at dublintheatrefestival.ie. Beckett Sa Craig, or Beckett on the Rock, is an ongoing series from theatre maker Sarah Jane Scaife in conjunction with Antivirk. It started in 2021 with a very special Irish language production of Happy Days, which starred Breed Nenochtan and was performed outdoors on Inishear. A second instalment, Beckett Sa Craig Gach na Mann, or Voices of Women, is coming to the Dublin Theatre Festival. The latest show is made up of three short Beckett works which tell female stories of isolation, memory, identity and abuse, and it's performed by actors Catriona Ní Mhoireachtaí, Fiona Lucia McGarry and Nuala Hayes. The director of Beckett Sa Craig is Sarah Jane Scaife, and she joins me now in studio. Sarah Jane, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
What Delighted was the here. Initial impulse to translate Beckett into Irish at the very beginning?
Okay, so at the very beginning, I've a 32-year engagement with the island of Inishear, so I suppose I was inspired by the people first and foremost, then the landscape, the language and the culture of the island. I've been going down there, as I say, for 32 years. I've brought up three children who all are kind of immersed in the landscape and have a very good relationship with the island. So when I thought of Happy Days, I just got this vision of Winnie buried up to her neck in rock, you know, and kind of almost like a flower. You see these beautiful fuchsia coloured flowers just popping up from the rock on the island of Inishear. And that's what I felt about Winnie. Also, there was I was down on the island at a funeral of a very well-loved woman. And when I was watching them lower her body into the sand, basically in the graveyard, I kind of thought, oh, that's amazing that Winnie isn't necessarily being buried up to her neck, but she's almost being taken back into the ground by the landscape and by the community. So there were a lot of things wrapped up in that inspiration. But language, landscape and culture were the basics.
And now you've gone with these three shorts, as Beckett would have called them. Why these three particular ones?
Why these three? Well, for me, the three short plays are so inextricably linked with Ireland's past in terms of women. So if you take Not I, you know, it's basically a woman howling from the margins of Irish society. You know, at some stage in her life, there has been some abuse carried on. You know, her parents split up straight after she was conceived almost. So she was placed in an institution and she's just trying to make sense of her life. But because she has been through such a trauma, it's not easy for her to make sense of it. So she's looking for forgiveness all the time. She's looking to see, will it be okay if she finally does something or she can finally articulate what it is, or what it means to be her. And in fact, all three women are actually trying to understand or trying to witness their own lives, trying to create a witness for themselves of their own lives. So for me, it was a no-brainer. And then actually, again, within Ishir, you know, the women on the island are just so extraordinary. And there were two things. One is the landscape can seem so bleak at times and so grey with the water all around. And if the sky is grey and the rock is grey. And then Singh talks about this this landscape and this weather and the slate. And then he talks about the red skirts being picked out by the women of the island and the joy that that red skirt would bring to the landscape. I just kind of united all those things. And there's also a poem by Ivan Boland in the mix. So we have projection, we have music, we have poetry, we have the three plays. So the whole thing is framed within the aesthetic of the island.
Not I is the one that people might be potentially more familiar with because of obviously the visual of the individual
mouth.
Lips and that being all you're supposed to see in theory from the staging. Tell us a little bit about Rockabye and about Footfall, just in case people are less familiar.
Yeah. So again, these later plays of Beckett, they're almost like pieces of installation art, which is where we got the whole inspiration for how we're framing the pieces. So Footfalls is a woman, a middle-aged woman of, say, about 40, who's pacing up and down this narrow beam of light in this beautifully tattered long trailing coat. And she's talking to her mother, whose voice comes from the dark, but we don't know if she's talking to her actual mother or the memory of her mother or what. So it's a very beautiful kind of piece of poetry that's told through movement and text and rhythm and repetition, which all his plays are. And then Rockabye is an old woman in a rocking chair who's remembering her life and how she left the outside world, so to speak, and became more and more enclosed within the prison of the house. And in the end, she puts on her mother's best black dress and rocks herself off to eternity, basically. So they're all very beautiful images, you know, pieces of sculpture in the dark, lit very beautifully by Stephen Dodd. And then framed within all of this are the projections which Killian Waters' arcade film created. So they're very beautiful landscape of Inishere, and the red skirts create the projection pieces.
Because it's something that can be a problem sometimes when you're staging Beckett, in that he was very restrictive about the nature of how plays should be staged, right the way down to the individual items of clothing that actors wore in them.
Yeah.
Is that something that can be a problem when you're trying to stage him?
Not for me, I don't think. And I've staged them all over the place. I've staged them, you know, as we say, outside in a field of rock in the back of an island in Ishir. I've staged them on the street as, you know, reflecting the homelessness that we have in our country. I've staged them like really in old houses and all over the place. But if you really try and get the essence of what he's trying to say and with all the pieces that he's using. So he's using the body, he's using the costume, he's using, say, for instance, Come and Go, he's using the hats, he's using all these things as this piece of installation art. And if you had a piece of installation art and you went to another country, say to a gallery, and you forgot one piece of it, like the video or the actress walking through or the sound of water coming down as a picture was being shown, and the artist came and that piece of the installation was missing, he'd say, that's not the piece I wrote. That's not the piece I created. So for me, respect for all those pieces, all the parts of the jigsaw are very important.
OK, we've some clips of Not I in Irish and in English. But before we hear this, Sarah Jane, the whole point of this piece for Beckett was that it was to be an assault on the senses, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So if you think of it, it's the woman has been assaulted. She has been assaulted by people. She's been assaulted by institutions, and she's been assaulted by the society that she was born into. So what other way can you make sense of that? But to also, you know, almost, you know, she hasn't spoken all her life. And all of a sudden at 70, she opens her mouth and she can't stop. And the words are just flooding out and out. And again, in the whole mental health area, we have this, you know, we have this kind of fracture between the body and the voice. And there's also another character in that play, that of the auditor, of somebody watching this mouth speaking and babbling incoherently to to a regular person. And the empathy that's coming from the auditor is very important.
Okay, let's take a clip of this. This is a recording of actor Catriona Ní Mhiarracú in a live performance of Ní Mise, or Not I.
And here the Hanaga staff in the heat and over the eggs and splown, Tommen, could have penos, dark age, itchy, the Varna could pack e, could a cup of vee, from whom the special my hassock ale, from whom the skin, tree, the hint and count and eager kaila, cutting chin a drapishy, my yarrick, half a wit, over the eggs and a swing of shut, deeper to her, not a hicks you could hop them, not if she yoke falling. Saul the gun an olint. Good on you, Reverend Longina, rather no my chuck on your dolling sheen he slew. She shinned or knowing mother if she an animus of a folicked. Ha, a captain could ever folicked. Cause so should go to oor in a sail, no there be an animus of a bind play sure. Mother hardy and new rev, an echer. With a keelic dar noy, a notion oot when be nose. The fact of all I knew the fact of Ellen who done umalong gun an fwish we let, no ever son vain. Rud a higshi gama, a notion oot when be nose, a really than he had oor. Talk of him out of ishi credwind, less than a parshi cheke ele, a joke of day.
And this is the Béarla version of Not I. It's also performed by Catriona Ní Mhiarracú, and audience members can opt to listen to this during the performance.
First thought was, oh, long after, sudden flash, she was being punished for her sins, a number of which then, further proof if proof were needed, flashed through her mind, one after the other, then dismissed as foolish. Oh, long after this thought dismissed, as she suddenly realised, gradually realised, she was not suffering. Imagine, not suffering. Indeed, could not remember, offhand, when she had suffered less, unless, of course, she was meant to be suffering. Ha! Thought to be suffering. Just as the odd time in her life, when clearly intended to be having pleasure, she was in fact having none, not the slightest. In which case, of course, that notion of punishment for some sin or other, or for the lot, or no particular reason, for its own sake, things she understood perfectly, that notion of punishment, which at first occurred to her, brought up as she had been to believe with the other waifs in a merciful God.
I want to ask you about the setting. This time you are indoors, obviously not out on in a sheer. How have you taken to the move indoors and to move it into a more traditional theatre setting? What's that been like?
Yeah, so we've created a kind of installation, like I was saying, reflecting off Beckett's initial kind of impetus to create installation pieces. So we had two women in the red skirts with the baskets on their back walk all through the landscape of Inishere. So they're the most beautiful. There's about six screens and it's projected onto screen. So they're the most beautiful visual moments accompanied by fantastic music by Matthew Martin, which is really stunning, along with Killian's videography. So these pieces are beautiful. They really frame and hold the pieces, the Irish pieces, the Beckett pieces and the Van Boland poem, Mhisce Eire.
And as I mentioned, so for those people maybe whose Gaeilge isn't as strong as it could be, you do have the option of wearing headphones on the night having an English version of it in your ears. How does that work?
Basically the actors recorded everything in English as well. So they have it in their ears. They can turn it on or off as they wish. So they can listen to the Irish if they want to or listen to the English. Plus we also have, for a couple of the pieces, we have surtitles. So you can drop So we're really trying to cover all the tracks and make it as inclusive as possible.
You know the work intimately. How does hearing them in Irish alter the play? I mean, or does it?
Oh, it does. The Irish is just so poetic, so beautiful. And there's something really fantastic about when you know a play so well, hearing it in another language, or even seeing it written as you're hearing the two languages. And for all of us all of us in Ireland, we have some idea of the language, and he repeats simple phrases. So it really engages as an Irish person. You can really recognise it.
Sarah Jane Scaife, thank you for joining us tonight on Arena Beckett. Sa Chraig Gach na Mann will be at the Project Arts Centre as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival from October 1st to 5th. Information and tickets again, you'll find that at dublintheatrefestival.ie. That is it for Arena for tonight. Produced by Reg Luby, Liam Murphy was our researcher. Broadcast coordination by Ollie Hamilton. Thank you to Amy O'Reilly, who is our broadcast engineer for the visuals tonight. And sound supervision was by Gar Duffy. I'm Rick O'Shea. Talk to you tomorrow night from 7. John Creedon is next.